Noon. Education Finance Committee will come to order. And let's see, Representative Detmer, if you wouldn't mind getting your minutes out and take a look, if members would take a look at the minutes from the March 24th meeting. And Representative Detmer would move approval of the minutes.
I approve the minutes.
Any questions or anything, or questions or anything on the minutes?
We have a quorum.
We do have a quorum.
Okay.
Oh, we do. Oh. Yes, is it Representative? You are the magic number 12, Representative Marquardt. So, so with that, all approve. All of those approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Detmer. All right, the first bill we're going to hear today is from Representative Garofalo, House File 2039. And so I will move the bill to get it formally in front of us. I move that House File 2039 be moved to the General Register, but with my intent to lay it over today for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And Representative Garofalo, welcome, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two things. This is my first time actually back to the Education Committee in almost 3 years, so I'm breaking out in hives as we speak, so that's good to know. And second, I just want to point out to the members of the committee that the chair prefers to go by her legislative nickname, which is J-Lo. J-Lo is her nickname, and G likes it when you call her that.
And we do have a strict code of conduct that we follow. The Education Finance Committee, Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, I would ask if Mr. Strom could briefly do an overview of how non-resident transportation works, for those who open and enroll, as well as how charter schools are, and then I will explain what the changes are in this bill and why I believe they're necessary.
All right, Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, there's also a description in the summary that members could refer to, but let me briefly set the background for you. In Minnesota, if a student lives more than 2 miles from school, the school is required to provide transportation for that student. The way that that student gets there, that is with the bus stops, the time of the bus, the routes that are taken, those are entirely under the control of the school board. So whether that transportation is provided by the school district or the school board, if the child's more than 2 miles from school, the state mandates transportation, but how they do that is up to the board. A charter school has a choice. A charter school may either choose to provide its own transportation services or to have the residence school or the school district within whose borders that charter school lies provide the transportation services. So the charter school makes a choice in that regard. In either case, the obligation for the charter school or the school board in which the charter school is located, if that's the method the charter chooses, is responsible for transporting the students resident to that district, and in the case of non-resident students attending the charter school, transporting those students from the border into the school. So the obligation essentially is from the border into the school in the method and manner that that either the charter school or the school board, whichever is providing the transportation, chooses. So for a non-resident student right now, a student essentially needs to get to the border to the designated pickup spot, and then the charter or the district would bring that student to the charter school at the beginning of the day and back to that drop-off place at the end of the day. Under this bill, under House File 2039, there is a new provision added for certain non-resident students. So this would apply only in the case of a student attending a charter school that's located in a district that the student is not resident to. And in this circumstance, the bill requires the school district to allow that charter student to ride from any one bus stop to any other on that that charter on that school district's bus, but then authorizes the school district to charge a fee for that transportation services. So in other words, if the student were to walk to the junior high and take the bus stop to a place close to that student's home at the border or something like that, the student would be able to choose that. The district providing that transportation services would then charge a fee equal to either 15 cents per mile or the school district's actual cost of transportation, which is whichever is less. So essentially what the bill is doing is requiring a district to provide certain transportation in limited cases of non-resident charter school pupils and allows a fee for that service.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me first of all say that I am actually embarrassed that I have to bring this bill before the legislature. In the situation involving that this bill pertains to, we're talking about existing buses that are already paid for or in use, existing routes with existing bus stops, where open space is on the buses, and the parents are offering to pay a fee, and the school district is saying no. This is in a situation where parents are clearly active and engaged, have made a choice for what's best for their child in terms of attending a public charter school. There are co-curricular activities involved where, as many people know, the more physically active a child is, the better they can have in their academic performance. It's embarrassing that we have to come to, that this parent has to come to the legislature and find someone to introduce a bill to have what is obviously common sense. The system exists for the service of the students, not for the adults. I view it as a system, a small symptom of a bigger problem. But the thing that's frustrating for me is I think about all the parents out there who don't know how to use the system, who are maybe not college educated like this parent, who are not as vigilant as this parent, or maybe don't have a legislator who's a little bit militant like I am. So it's just, I want to apologize to the committee, but sometimes we have to do these things. It seems pretty micromanaging, but again, it's pretty embarrassing that a school district can't figure this out on their own.
Thank you.
I'm happy to. I have no invited testifiers. The parent is actually out of town, and it's probably a good thing. So.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 2039? All right, seeing none, we'll take questions from committee members. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, and I like the bill. I'm just curious, our school district charges a bus fee, and it's kind of a random figure, and so I'm just curious if you know how that would play out for those types of school districts that charge a fee for just a set number, like $150 a year, $150 a semester, or something like that.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I want to defer to Mr. Strom on this, but I think the fee in question you're talking about, I believe it's for those who are under the 2-mile statutory limitation. Is that correct, Mr. Strom? Is that the elective service the school districts don't have to offer, or is that the mandatory service they have to offer?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representatives Garofalo and Peterson, there are several ways a district may charge a fee for transportation services. The most common one of those is for particularly elementary students under the 2 miles. Districts will often have a sliding fee charge for that kind of transportation services. Part of this is a throwback to the old transportation funding formula, which essentially provided full funding for elementary students 1 mile or further from schools, and for secondary students 2 miles or further from schools. Even when that formula was in place, the mandate was always 2 miles, regardless of the age of the student. But those fees, there can be a variety of fees for pupil transportation service. Essentially, generally speaking, they don't apply to the to and from transportation to the school district if a student is a resident of that, or to the charter school if the student is resident to within the borders of there or from the border to the school. So there's a number of scenarios in the fee law that are addressed by a fee. I'm guessing that this fee with actual costs involved would maybe in some cases be cheaper than a set amount of $150 per year, but it would really depend on the circumstances.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, does the school district own their own buses, or do they contract with a bus company?
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I'm going by memory here. I should probably just say I don't know. But the important thing is to note that this particular family actually has students who are in the public school, not the charter school, but in the public school, who are already at the bus stop and already get on the bus. So they're not the parents involved here are not asking for any new buses, any new routes, any new stops, any new accommodations. This is existing personnel in place. But I don't recall whether it's privately they contract it out privately or whether they own their own service.
Well, Madam Chair, some of my districts where there's a contract with the bus company, usually you can arrange this with the bus company, but apparently the school district is in charge here, so thank you.
Other questions from committee members? All right, seeing none, Representative Garofalo, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pretty cut and dry issue. Like I said, I'm just embarrassed I got to bring it before you, so thank you.
All right, thank you. And with that, I'll renew my motion that House Bill, 2039, thank you. It's unfortunate getting older. House File 2039 be re-referred to the General Register with my intention of laying it over today for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Is Representative Runback here?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome, Representative Runbeck. And I will go ahead and move your bill, House File 332, to be moved to the, re-referred to the General Register, but with my intention of laying it over today for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I'm here with House File 332, which deals with the issue of dyslexia. And we have, some say, as many as 1 in 5 children suffer from dyslexia in our schools. And we have a great group of parents and an organization called Decoding Dyslexia that have focused on it and really want to be able to make sure parents can partner with their school districts and get the proper instruction and specialized treatment for their children. So the bill essentially works from existing law that was put in place in 2011 dealing with literacy plans at each school district level. Parents who have tried to access and get informed about what schools are offering have found that the information is somewhat inaccessible, is not consistent across school districts, and does not do enough to really identify what might be available and how their children could be assessed. So the bill would add some language, and it also then links the aid that school districts or that school districts are eligible for to the performance on this plan. And I do have some folks here that can explain, I guess, the need and what their children, how they benefit from the proper instruction and specialized training for dyslexic students. So we have Rachel Berker. You want to start, Rachel?
Welcome. Please just state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rachel Berger. I'm a representative of Decoding Dyslexia Minnesota, and I'm also a parent of a dyslexic child. So I want to thank you for hearing us today. There's an issue that we're facing in our educational system here in Minnesota. The National Education Reading Report Card 2014 reports that only 41% of our fourth graders are reading at grade level proficiently. I know as a parent of a dyslexic child that there's some importance in recognizing these kids, and potentially that is linked to helping to bring up that number. I come here as a voice of our group of a group of parents who love their children and are engaged in their education and would do anything to help them succeed. Our schools currently aren't systematically set up to help these children in all the ways that they could be, and we're working diligently as a group of folks with legislators and others to try to make some changes that could potentially help these kids as well as other struggling readers. Right now, a lot of these children either don't qualify for services and they're left to kind of invisibly struggle on their own. They might get some interventions, etc., but it's still a very big struggle to make gains appropriately. Or if they do qualify for services, they're caught in that, again, where it's not the correct service specific to their need, and they still struggle invisibly. They make really slow gains. The kids are frustrated. The parents are frustrated. The kids are doing the work, but everyone else is blaming them for not trying or not trying hard enough. Um, So I guess one of the points I want to, I'm asking here, is that we acknowledge the complications that we have systematically here, and to help to not leave the parents on the hook to bear these burdens alone, that we help to change the trajectory for these students within our public schools. And this bill is just kind of the beginning of some of the work that we're looking to do over the next couple of years with both, again, legislators, the school boards, the Department of Education. We're trying to really work to provide a solution that everyone can, you know, collaborate together on.
Thank you, Ms. Berger. Welcome.
Thank
you. State your name for the record.
My name is Amy Schulting. And I'll take a minute just to tell you my story, and then, of course, we're happy to talk in more detail and answer questions. So I wear many hats in the world of dyslexia. I'm a former K-12 classroom teacher with experience primarily teaching grades K through 3. I have a master's degree in education and with a principal endorsement. I also have a PhD in clinical psychology. So as a psychologist, I currently have two professional roles. I'm currently a research scientist at Duke University in area of education policy research, and I'm also a psychologist in private practice here in the Twin Cities. So most importantly, I'm here today because I'm the mother of three young boys with dyslexia who, like so many others that Rachel described, have academic needs that are not being met in the public schools. So when my first son started to struggle to read, I was shocked when his school did not provide appropriate assessment or intervention. So I sought an outside evaluation and determined that he has dyslexia. But interestingly, when I brought this information to the school, I was mystified to learn that they don't use the word dyslexia, nor do they provide effective intervention for struggling readers like my son, who, as Rachel mentioned, is up to 20% of our population of students. And now, in my clinical practice, I hear the same story every day. And I have to say, my heart breaks each time a parent calls and tells me this story, because remarkably, they all have the exact same story. Parents describe having early concerns about their child's reading difficulties, often as early as kindergarten or preschool. But they were told by the school that reading would click, or that the child would grow out of it, or that they would improve with the pull-out services provided by the school. But they didn't. And the child's reading did not improve, and parents watched helplessly as their child fell further and further behind, with the child often becoming anxious about school and discouraged about their own abilities and potential, at which point families reach out and contact us for an outside evaluation. I think this is most concerning because we've known about dyslexia since the late 1800s. And effective intervention has been around almost 100 years. Yet the 1 in 5 students with dyslexia, up to 20%, continue to be denied proper identification and services in our schools. And as you can imagine, not learning to read has devastating consequences. Dyslexic students are more likely to drop out of high school, and if they do graduate, very few attend a 4-year college, because 92% of struggling readers in third grade will not go on to college. But it doesn't have to be this way, because by definition, dyslexics have average to above average or even gifted or genius IQs. They are talented and can make a lasting positive contribution to society if they learn to read, and they deserve to learn to read. That's why I'm thrilled to be here with you today to support the local literacy plan with incentive aid and the definition of dyslexia, which will provide much needed clarity to better support the many struggling readers we have in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schulting.
Madam Chair, that concludes our testimony, so we will take questions if you have them.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Rumbach. Is there anyone else from the general public who's here that wishes to testify on House File 332? All right. Not seeing anyone come down. We'll go to questions. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Rumbach. I'm really happy that you brought this bill forward, because I do think that there's a problem with dyslexia not being identified and handled in our schools. However, my question is related to the reporting for the literacy plan to the commissioner, and I'm just wondering, what are you hoping to get out of that mandate?
Representative Rumbach.
I wonder if we have testimony here that can address that. It's intended to be an incentive, and I think at the moment the aid is automatic. Perhaps you could describe that.
Ms. Berger?
Sure. I'll do my best here. As a parent who tried to, my son was diagnosed in kindergarten. Knowing the diagnosis and what sorts of things he needs, I attempted to find our local literacy plan, which was passed with legislation, I believe, and I'm not sure if it was 09 or 11. 11? Okay. So I attempted to access information to understand what would my child be getting in terms of services, et cetera. There was nothing accessible to me, online or other, and this was legislation that was passed that districts would put forth a local adopt the local literacy policy and put forth information for the public. So what we're hoping to do is that this would tighten things up a little bit, make these literacy plans available to the public as was intended, and then offer incentive aid based upon that legislation that had been previously passed. So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, are they getting aid currently? You could just nod your head. They're getting aid, but the plans have not been necessarily been put forth as legislation intended. So currently they get the aid, but we don't have access to that. And the legislation had said districts need to put forth a literacy plan and make it accessible.
Thank you. Representative,
I'm sorry, that was very long-winded. Did I answer the question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On line 2.3, the district must post its literacy plan on the official school district website. So, I mean, it's possible that school districts aren't complying with the current law. But, I mean, they are supposed to be doing that, obviously. I don't know if you contacted the district. I'm trying to get away from additional mandates. And if there's a good purpose for it, you know, that's fine. But they're not even complying with the mandate that's already in there. I'm not sure what we're... I would rather that they comply with, I guess, the existing law.
Oh, I would love it if they'd comply, too.
Mr. Strom, if you could you just clarify for the committee what the current status is of the law and what the districts are required to do? Well, and maybe when that last change was made?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, the local literacy aid is relatively new. It's a few years old. And so districts are, I think, in their third year now of receiving revenue under that proposal. Essentially, as Representative Peterson said, there is the requirement in current law that the district posts that plan. There are modifications to the plan in this bill that would be required to be made. And as I read Section 2, essentially it would make the commissioner certify or otherwise ascertain that the plan has been received in order for the aid to be paid. As the language currently reads, the district's aid should be dependent on them developing a plan. I think this, in my view, strengthens that language some and requires that plan before the aid be paid.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think part of the issue is that it's hard sometimes to navigate school district websites, or if they have schools, it's hard to navigate those, because I have read many literacy plans in this state since it was in our omnibus bill of 2011, and I was a part of negotiating that and also a co-author to former Representative Myra's local literacy bill. But I think to the extent districts could make their websites more consumer friendly, we would find them, because I spent hours going through the websites. And so maybe this is just a signal to the Department of Education just to, you know, send out a memo perhaps. I mean, nothing that mandates, but just reminds them that they need to have their plan posted. And as Mr. Strom said, perhaps this language will strengthen the indication too that now changes that'll be made because of the addition of this language, if it's included in the omnibus bill and becomes law, would require some changes in the plan, and maybe that'll motivate districts to make their their literacy plans a little bit more accessible to the public.
And Madam Chair, also just that I think that we're adding a lot more sort of flesh on the bones and giving more content in terms of what should be described on that website.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Continuing to plow the website area that Chair Erickson touched on, a couple of questions around that and others. What's the purpose of posting the literacy plan to the website?
Ms. Berger.
Well, I believe that most districts are supposed to post the literacy plan so that parents have access to understanding whether their children are getting the instructional materials that will have them reading well by third grade and have the ability to see how those are practiced.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, to the testifier, thank you. I don't see, though, a requirement. I don't see a requirement that these be posted in languages other than English. And if you've got a school district with significant immigrant population, as we do in greater Minnesota, as we do in suburban and urban Minnesota, and given I think you've testified or folks with you have testified that there tends to be a genetic component to dyslexia, inheritable.
Yes.
You may have a parent who has limited English who also is dyslexic, and asking them to read a English literacy plan on a hard-to-find school district website may not accomplish the goal that you've identified.
Mr. Schulting?
I think we agree. I agree. And I think if there were ways to have it easily accessible and translated, that would be the ideal. If we can go that extra step, I think that's fantastic. I think in terms of going back to the question about the commissioner, one issue is just there doesn't seem to be a central recipient to ensure that it has been completed initially. But we'd be thrilled with these extra steps if those were possible.
So, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
I guess to the author, you may want to consider an amendment to really accomplish the goal you've set out there. I'm looking at lines 1.22 and 1.23. The plan should identify staff development needs, including a program to meet those needs. What if there is insufficient funds? I think of for staff development for the literacy plan. I think of years when school districts are in a regular cycle adopting a new curriculum in math or science or social studies. They're putting a lot of money into textbook purchases, into staff development. We may have come through with new standards in the area, and staff may require new training in the new standards that they're expected to implement. There can be many other calls on staff development funds. So, Representative Runbeck, what do you suggest there, or how do we align your language with that reality?
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, I think we all know that staff development is an area that is, you know, we've seen there's a lot of demands made on it within a school district. And at this point, I think we're simply saying that the district needs to, you know, prioritize, and there's certainly competing needs, but this certainly has to be one that they are considering.
One last quick question. Representative Runbeck, since the department now will have to certify or ascertain the receipt of a literacy plan, and I presume certify that it is compliant with the statute, how many FTEs at the department do you anticipate this requiring them to add?
Representative.
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, don't believe we addressed that issue. So I, you know, not knowing really how that department works, but we have not heard from anyone that there's some needs in that regard.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative
Runbeck.
You, Madam Chair, the department is here, so they could respond to some of this.
All right. Well, and that's thank you, Representative Erickson. I would invite the department if you had any comments you wish to share pertinent to this bill. Welcome, Mr. Uni. If you just introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Ado Shuni. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Department of Education. Representative Dabney, to your question on how many FTEs this require, we haven't had the specific analysis of how many FTEs this would require. This would require some new and extra work for our members in data to do. Looking at our comments from staff, it doesn't look like it's an onerous push for members. We have been meeting with the advocates and Representative Runbeck on the definitions and on the bill, and we've been working for quite a lengthy time, so there's been some good back and forth there. If you do want an estimate of a particular FTE cost down to a quarter or any cost, we could certainly try to look into that.
And thank you, Mr. Ernie. And yes, if there were, if that would be possible, I think that would be helpful as the committee is moving forward with our plans and what we may include in an omnibus bill.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Ernie? Oh. All right. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ernie, could you explain to us the tracking that the commissioner has to do in order to ensure that payments are made for the proficiency aid and the growth aid? What's that process? Because there has to be some kind of information. I mean, maybe you just get it from the MARS reporting that's provided or through some other data receptacle, but there has to be a way for the commissioner to know how to direct Mr. Melcher and his staff to send out this payment. Could you explain that?
Mr. Ernie.
Madam Chair, committee members, my apologies, Representative Erickson. I don't have that process information in front of me. I can certainly provide that to you. I can talk to Dr. Melcher as well as other staff members to get that, and we can certainly provide that to the committee.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Ernie. I think, Madam Chair and members, that would be good for us to know in light of perhaps some of this language then wouldn't need to be included, some of the specificity that has been added under proficiency aid and growth aid, if we knew how the commissioner was handling changes in literacy plans and then tracking both the aid and the growth, because there is specific formulas for sending out that aid, and I want to know how all of that is occurring, and I would hope members would too, for the sake of transparency. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. And so, Mr. Ooney, if that would be possible for you to send that to the committee, we'd very much appreciate it. Thank you. Ms. Berger, did you have a comment? You look like you were ready to say something. Go ahead.
I guess I would like to ask, aren't there staff already on board to review the literacy policies that, you know, were requested and in the 11 legislation? And if there was already staff needs met for that, because this was the intent, how is this asking for more staff?
Mr. Ooney, would you like to comment?
Madam Chair, committee members, that's something I'm going to have to look into specifically. I think in our staff comments we've had that we are well positioned to receive these local literacy plans. I'm not sure, based on the final language, if there would be any additional analysis. I don't want to state for certain when that wouldn't be the case, that we don't. I certainly want to go back and make sure. It very well could be that we're very well positioned and that there wouldn't be any cost, but I want to be absolutely certain that that is or isn't the case.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been listening all the way around, and I'm not sure about the current status. And I was wondering if there was anyone here from the School Boards Association or the Minnesota School Administrators Board that have tried to comply with current law and get the word out about the importance of what is already being asked for to the individual parents and people in the school districts of how we should be meeting the current law. And it seems to me that if we have had successful staff development kind of things, there wouldn't be such a increasing need for 332. And I would like to hear some stories. We've got these good three stories here, but I know there's many others, and I know that the school districts must be trying to address the issue somehow, and I'd like to hear a current success story from the School Boards Association or from the school administrators or special education development kind of things, if there's anyone that could share.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And I do see some of those representatives in the audience. Any of you wish to come down and provide comment?
Right. Madam Chair.
Yeah. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While they're coming down, Mr. Strom, I know, can provide us.
Come on down.
I think Mr. Strom could provide us with the information about the amount of literacy aid that's received by districts. Correct, Mr. Strom? Because I think that's been a part of many of our printouts in the past.
Madam Chair,
thank
Representative
you, Mr. Strom.
Erickson, yes, we'd be happy to have a printout brought down to you here. The printout does currently show that all districts are receiving literacy aid, and I'll have one of those printed and brought down momentarily.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Welcome. If you'd like to introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Denise Dietrich with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I do want to just say that one of the ways that the school boards intersect with the School Boards Association intersects with literacy plans is we do go out to school districts and we help school districts with their strategic plans and how to integrate the literacy into the world's best workforce goals that they have, and so that they can be making continual improvement on the outcomes. But besides that, I can't comment on much more besides that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. Mr. Amoroso.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Gary Amoroso, Executive Director of Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Quite frankly, this has not been an issue that has been on our radar. We have not heard of this issue from our members. But if there is a concern out there, we'd be willing to work with the author and the group to see if there's a way that we can further get the word out if it appears as though the message isn't being heard. Because we certainly want to ensure that all of our members comply with all statutes, to the letter of the law. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
A question for Mr. Strom. Or maybe Mr. Withers. Is there some other group that I might not be thinking of that might have success stories on current law to share?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, at the risk of finding people to duck in the audience, some of the individual district folks may be able to tell you relatively quickly, certainly before the hearing's over today, what they do on their literacy plans. I would expect a few of the larger districts could probably tell you very quickly what their literacy plan looks like and whether it's posted and what process they go through to develop that plan. But I don't know any of those details myself.
Representative Murphy.
I'll be silent.
I keep eyeballing the crowd, but no one's giving me the signal they want to come down.
I turned around, too.
Oh, wait. We have someone who appears to be coming down.
Madam Chair, Committee, Ann Hobby with Parents United for Public Schools. This is an issue we're hearing a lot frequently from parents about. It's a sticky wicket, dyslexia. And these are not parents who are looking to have their children identified for special ed. They want reading interventions that work. So, as a former classroom teacher, I can tell you, in the 80s, when I went to McAllister and I got my teaching license, I felt ill-equipped to teach children how to read afterwards. And to this day, I was very successful teaching reading, teaching literacy to older students, but those children who struggled, I never really felt like I got the right professional development for. So granted, this is many years out of the profession, but I can tell you that parents want teachers to know how to address this in the classroom, and there are a lot of kids who have this, and it's just, like I said, no one can quite get their arms around it, but I know that a lot of parents are going outside the school districts to get the help that they need, so there are people who are having success with this, and maybe these two moms can speak to that kind of outside of school success, because we have something to learn from the folks who are working with their kids. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Harvey.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? All right. Seeing none, Representative Rumbeck, I'll give you last comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee. It seems every time we are before a committee, if we come back to the same sort of disbelief that, you know, here's sort of a hole in the system, and there's a need to fill it. And thanks for the parents who have really identified the need and are working hard, and hopefully they can become better partners with our school districts on solving dyslexia.
Thank you, Representative Rumbeck. And I thank you for all of your efforts to bring attention to this. I think it is certainly well-merited, and I appreciate all of your efforts. So with that, I would move that House File 332 be referred to the General Register, but with my intention of laying it over today. And with that, thank you very much, and thank you to your two testifiers for coming back again before the committee. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks,
thank
committee.
You. All right. Representative Seltzer. Welcome, Representative Seltzer, and I guess welcome to the testifier table. You're here with us every day, which we appreciate. But if you would like to formally move House File 1542, and I believe the motion is that we are going to refer it to the State Government Finance Committee where it needs to be heard.
Yes, and Madam Chair, I'm wondering, did you want me to move my delete all amendment now to get the bill in the shape I would like it, or make the general motion first?
Yeah, well, let's go ahead and move the bill first, and then you can offer your amendment.
Okay. Yes, I'd like to move House File 1542 to the State Government Finance Committee.
Very well. And with that, if you want to go ahead and bring your amendment, members should be in your packets. I believe it's the DE2 amendment. And Representative Seltzer, this gets the bill in the shape that you would like it. If you'd like to tell us a little bit about your amendment.
I certainly will. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. And I just want to start off by saying that we probably all know someone a child who in high school or junior high has had an experience abroad through a program, and many of these students have wonderful experiences where they learn a lot about a new culture. They make lifelong friends. They're great ambassadors for the United States, and they come home with wonderful memories. And we certainly want to encourage those types of broadening experiences. However, unfortunately, that is not always the case. And sometimes these children have accidents and illnesses which require hospitalization, and unfortunately, sometimes these students even die. And so today I am presenting you House File 1542, which we have named the Tyler Hill Sunshine Bill, named after an amazing young man who died overseas at the age of 16 under tragic circumstances during an experience abroad program run by a well-known organization, and we'll have some testimony on that later from Cheryl Hill, Tyler's mother. Although organizations that bring our that bring students here to the United States have many laws that govern them, and they should, and they also are required to register these programs that bring students here with the Secretary of State's office, I have to tell you that I was shocked when I found that there is no law in the state of Minnesota, no law in any state in the country, and no federal laws that even provide a sunshine law around letting folks know what the safety records of the study and experience abroad program are. So our bill here in the delete all amendment is our attempt to start to rectify that situation. So I will just go briefly through the delete all amendment. So as you see, starting on page 1, lines 1.3 through page 2, line 2.9, programs, you can read through that and you see that programs that bring students from other countries to the state of Minnesota are required to register with the Secretary of State's office, and all the various requirements are listed there. The programs, as I mentioned, that recruit students to study abroad or have an experience abroad are not required to register with the Secretary of State's office, so we don't have a definitive record of who's even here, which programs are here doing that. So you see that we've created Subdivision 1 in our Delete All Amendments so that we could attach new regulations to current law to cover registration and other requirements for programs who recruit our K-12 students for these experiences abroad. So if you go to page 2, we've created Subdivision 2, as I mentioned, starting on line 2.10 on page 2. Here are that you can read through our proposed new requirements around placing Minnesota students in travel abroad programs. You see that a school district or charter school with enrolled students who participate in a foreign exchange or study abroad program must provide to the school districts information on the number of deaths, illnesses, and incidents that require hospitalization to those school districts. And then the school districts also are required to ask, but not require, that eligible students, if you look on line 226 to 229, they're required to ask eligible students, and those would be obviously students who are of age, and or the families and guardians of those students, to disclose any deaths, hospitalizations, and accidents that required hospitalization during their experience abroad program. I'm sorry, I meant illnesses and accidents that required hospitalization. And what this does is provides a nice check. You know, families may come forward to the school district with an experience, an unfortunate experience, that perhaps the study of the experience abroad program that has promoted this experience has not reported. So that's just a nice checks and balance that we have in there. Then you see that the school districts or charter schools are then required to report, and this is important, the numerical data to the Minnesota Department of Education. And so in that way, we are protecting student data privacy rights. So we are not transmitting names. You see that MDE must also post on its website links to the U.S. Department of State's Consular Information Program and other websites to provide safety information. And just as an aside, members may remember that last year we passed a post-secondary study abroad program that requires the Secretary of State's office to provide links to these same information sources. And so the Minnesota Department of Education will simply need to provide links to the Secretary of State's office. The Minnesota Department of Education will be aggregating the data. Again, this protects student privacy, and they will post it on the MDE website. You see on lines 3.3 to 3.7 that we, on page 3, that we encourage, but we do not require school districts with a written agreement between school districts and charter schools and program providers to develop policies to ensure students' health and safety, but we don't require that because local school districts certainly have the safety of their students at heart. So if we look at page 3, lines 3.3 to 3.26, you find the registration requirements for these programs, and they're similar to the registration requirements we found in Subdivision 1. And I just want to make clear, if we look at page 3, line 3.27 to 3.29, this puts the onus on the program reporter, program providers. They must provide the information to the districts and charter schools with enrolled students participating in the provider's program. And we do also underneath that, 3.30 to 3.32. We do have some some language around there to ensure immunity from civil and criminal liability. Excuse me, for the school districts, the charter schools, and the Department of Education. Finally, I just want to note, excuse me, on page 4, lines 4.9 to 4.11, I'm glad I'm almost done here, that an educational agency or institution, they cannot sell their directory information to a foreign exchange or study or travel abroad program unless the program provider is registered with the Secretary of State's office. And you do see that we do have an appropriations. We did request a fiscal note, and we'll certainly get that information to the committee as soon as we have it. There will be a modest appropriation for the Secretary of State's office and also the Minnesota Department of Education for registration and then travel abroad program oversight. I just want to mention, before we either open up to questions or have the other testifiers, that we, in addition to our testifiers, we do have Lisa Larson here, and I just have to thank Lisa, who displayed the patience of Job as we went through iteration after iteration of this brand new legislation. There was no model for it, and so she's been wonderfully helpful. And Julie Strother from the Secretary of State's office, who has also been tremendously helpful, and they're also here to answer questions. And I'd like to thank both of them for their time and effort and all the stakeholders who have helped in the construction of this bill. And so, Madam Chair, I'm glad I'm done. And I just wondered if you wanted to open up for questions now or hear the testifiers.
Yes, well, I think let's go ahead and vote on your DE2 amendment so that the bill is in the shape that you would like. And thank you for that very thorough description of it. Representative Hertas, did you have a question about the amendment?
No.
Okay. All right, so any questions on the amendment itself? If not, all in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, Representative Seltzer, so your bill now has been amended, and we've got it as amended in front of us. And with that, is any questions before we would turn to testifiers? Representative Newton?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Seltzer. Why would you want school districts to send a report in the event that there was no death or serious illness? That's one question. The other is, you know, defining illness. Is that, you know, if someone catches a cold while they're on a trip, or is it something more serious? Is it somehow delineated as to what the illness would be? But more importantly is, why would you have a district complete a report if there's no record of a death or illness?
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you very much, and Representative Newton, that's a very good point, and this bill is a work in progress, so that's something, maybe some language we could add so that we aren't adding an extra mandate. And then the language, and if it's not clear, we can work on that also, is intended to convey that it would have to be an illness that required hospitalization.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Seltzer, I was just reading the text here, and I was wondering if on line 3.27, do you think August 1st is an early enough date to have program providers provide the information and assemble it in a report that would provide parents with enough time to make appropriate decisions before a school year begins, in which they may be going off in just 30 days? Maybe in September. Do you think that should maybe be a little bit earlier?
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hertas, and I'm certainly open to changing the dates. We just thought, you know, some of these programs might occur in the, you know, over the summer too, and so we give it until August 1st, and then, you know, generally students don't go in the beginning, you know, in the fall as they're getting set into their school year. So we thought that November 1st would be some time for the Minnesota Department of Education to aggregate and post the data, but we certainly could discuss that.
Thank you. Additional questions, Representative Hertas?
Just one more. Do we know how many different programs or how many providers there might be. I guess I was wondering if there's enough of them, if the annual registration fee might be enough to be self-funding in the future after this is established, if adopted.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hertaus, and that's just the point. We don't know, so I guess once we make them register, we'll know.
Okay. Good point.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I've got some background in quality and monitoring from outside, and why you would start out with reporting everything, even if it's zeros, are a couple reasons. One, if you've got a new system going through, you're confirming that you didn't miss, you know, some reporting of, you didn't realize that something was happening. If they send a report in and it's no, you know, it's all zeros, everything was fine, you might not have known that they were even participating. You know, you make sure that there are checks and balances, and once you're confirmed, then you can decrease unneeded reports. But frankly, on a new system, for thoroughness, it's very common to require reporting even negative occurrences just to flesh out your system. So I would say they're fine starting out. I like your idea of delineating or granularity on illnesses or events. And that could even be taken care of in rulemaking, because there are things we might not think of. But I support the intent of this legislation.
Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Seltzer, thank you for bringing the bill up. So I'm just trying to understand it. I want to make sure so I get it right. So if a school district is participating in a study abroad program, we're going to take the data from that study abroad program, make sure it's reported to MDE, and then that's going to be published.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Krisha, for your question. Right, but the data will be aggregated, and there won't be, the student names will not be forwarded. So to protect, I just want to make that point. That's really important, to protect students. But exactly, so then parents, guardian school districts, when they're thinking about partnering with a program to provide an experience abroad, over time we'll have some basis from the point of view of the safety record as to whether or not they want to engage with that particular partner.
Representative Grisha.
So thank you, Madam Chair. And so Representative Seltzer, that helps. So do you see this as a, and maybe it's just a bare bones, but a sort of a rating system, an ability to go look and see, here's the five companies that we're using for study abroad, here's their safety record, I don't know if I want to do that, but here's the reports of things that have happened. I mean, do you see that as some type of rating system, perhaps, or an ability to look at, and there's a specific reason why I'm trying to figure this out.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Krisha. I guess I hadn't looked at it that way, though you could, I suppose, but the way I, the intent of the bill is to provide information so that on the safety records of these programs, so that parents, guardians, school districts can make informed decisions before partnering with them. So I guess that's a different way of maybe stating it.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm trying to build support for, because I think it's a great idea. And here's the other thing. Would you also include, like, we had a band trip in Little Falls, and they all went on a Carnival cruise. Would we also include programs like that? And the reason I'm getting this, and I'll just cut right to it, and maybe Mr. Strom, is if we're going to build this type of rating system where we're going to offer this, why is it in the jurisdiction of this committee? Isn't this a commerce thing? Is this something that we would be regulating somewhere else? I'm a little concerned that we may be trying to do something that, what we're really trying to do is build a rating system for companies. And I'm just looking for different ways to look at this, and I want to make sure we don't pigeonhole this into education when maybe there's a broader implication of what we can be doing for the safety of our kids.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Krishan. That certainly would be something to think about for the future. This is a starting point, so my bill doesn't cover that scope. That doesn't mean that there aren't other areas to look at. But for right now, as this is the first of its kind in the nation, I've limited it to this scope. But that doesn't mean, again, that we couldn't look at it in the future and, you know, introduce, you know, an expanded bill in commerce.
Representative Christian.
Madam Chair, are we re-referring this?
Yes, this is going to be re-referred to state government finance, and it may need to go to another couple of stops as well, looking at the amendment.
Okay. And so, Representative Seltzer, certainly I'm going to vote for this if this is going to come for a vote, but I would ask that you look at the broader implications of that type of regulatory environment, if maybe there's a commerce issue, or see exactly where that falls so that we can get the best type of information to our families and our parents. Like I said, I think of the cruises, and I think of all the different things that our kids go on, and that information could be very helpful. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Christian. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Seltzer, I apologize if I missed this in your opening remarks, but what information do parents provide the district or the charter when their child is going abroad? I mean, is the provider listed? Because that's really who's in charge of the child while he or she studies abroad. Or is there just a parent notification that the child will be an exchange student this year? Do you know how that works?
Representative Seltzer.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, I do not know how that works right now, but I think it's, I don't think that, and you know, perhaps I could call up one of my testifiers who's the real expert.
And I'll wait when you call on her because I think she could answer it. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Newton, did you have another question?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Seltzer, having lived abroad for a long time and having my children come back and forth, and attending school in different countries, I would be more concerned, rather than reporting illnesses, with making sure that whatever company is providing the education, that they're fully insured and that there's some guarantee that if something does happen in a foreign country, that the children are covered by insurance. You know, that sometimes is an issue where most countries of the world have universal health care, but it doesn't apply necessarily to people coming from outside the country who are temporarily residing in the country. So I would, you know, as you're looking at the information that you want on the individual organizations, that they indicate who their insurer would be and what kind of guarantee there is that the insurance would be there when it's needed. Thank you.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Thank you, Representative Newton. That's an excellent suggestion, and I'll look to see if we can incorporate that in the language.
All right. So I think maybe this would be a good time to bring up your testifiers, Representative Seltzer.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So I would like to call up Cheryl Hill, mother of Tyler Hill, and her husband, Alan, is going to be next to her for support. And then we also have Rosario, and I am not going to butcher her name. I will ask her to give her full name, who was with Tyler on the same Experience Abroad program that he passed away on.
All right, well, welcome. Ms. Hill, if you would want to go ahead and lead off, and just ask that you introduce yourself for the record, and if you're representing any particular organization, to let us know.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members. My name is Cheryl Hill, and I represent and am founder and executive director of Clear Cause. Our cause is clear: save lives and protect our students abroad. I am the proud mother of two sons and host mom to 8 international youth for more than 12 years. I get how exciting, how valuable, and how informative these cultural exchange programs can be. Our exchange students have named their kids after our children, and when my son died, there were tears all over the world. When the opportunity came to send our son on a student program abroad, we wanted to give him the world. We did our homework and our personal best to vet out the program and keep him safe. We believed the program's claim of a solid safety record and no deaths in 50 years. Our son, barely 16, was an A honor student. He was a leader and a role model, a hero in his school for single-handedly reporting a bomb threat. He was an MVP in rugby on a U19 team. I'm going to cry. I'll move through it. I'm just going to set you up right now. It hurts right here when I talk about him. Tyler died a preventable death on a people-to-people program in Japan in 2007. He would be alive today had he received timely and appropriate medical attention. There is evidence that my son tried to ask for medical attention and none was provided. A leader on his tour denies that he asked for help. Our son tried to dial 911 to seek medical attention. The emergency number in every other country is different. It is 119 in Japan. Our children do not know how to identify or mitigate risk or advocate for themselves when things go wrong. We are on a mission to change that, to lift and raise a bar so that they all come back. Tyler was not the first, nor is he the only death on a people-to-people program. Study abroad student programs encourage our most precious assets, our children, to attend programs in foreign countries, but there is no requirement for any of them to disclose their safety record to anyone. Young Minnesotans who die abroad are irreparably harmed, and they are invisible. Their deaths and injuries are not even a meaningful statistic. Animals and coffee beans have more protective laws than our children on these study abroad programs. Student tourism is a massive $200+ billion industry operating with no state or federal protective policies whatsoever. The World Youth Student Travel Confederation invites you to tap into this lucrative market. Our kids have become commodities. Chaperones are led to believe that if they get 10 or 20 to sign up, they get to go for free. There was no way for us to know that the program had prior fatalities. There is no way for you to know how many of these programs have placed our students in harm, and let me demonstrate that. There is no way for us to know until the Tyler Hill K-12 Sunshine Law passes and shines a light on the dark side of study abroad. Poor providers must be disclosed, and they must stop providing poorly. We founded ClearCause to help others. A Minnesota school disclosed to me that their third-party program sent students to Honduras in areas where the United States Department of State does not allow employees, in areas where CNN does not send reporters. A Minnesota mom called me in angst because her daughter did not get timely medical attention in Guatemala. She had to be hospitalized with several other students upon arrival in Texas with dengue fever. She has residual joint pain that impacts the quality of her life today. Failure to provide timely and appropriate medical care in a foreign country should be criminal negligence. It is here. Another Minnesota mom phoned me tearfully reporting that her high school daughter was groped sexually in an elevator by two European men. When she tried to report it, the program blamed her daughter, threatened, "You're not going to get your school credits, you're not going to get a refund, and good luck getting home, you're on your own." On a broader scale, students have been abandoned, abused, trafficked, hurt, killed, starved, lost, and abused on overpriced and underperformed programs. I support them all over our country. This legislation will be a model for other states, for other parents who are pushing their policymakers like you to protect our children. These kids are our future. These programs are important and valuable opportunities. We hosted 4 students after the death of our son. We must ensure their safety. I will never look into my son's eyes or hear his voice or kiss his face again. So I'm begging you to please pass this bill. Pass the Tyler Hill K-12 Sunshine Law. Vote yes for transparency. Vote yes to stop poor providers from providing poorly. Vote yes so that other states can follow our lead and other countries America's model. Vote yes so that parents can make informed decisions. Vote yes so that our children come back better, not broken, with school credits instead of coffins. Vote yes to save lives and protect our kids abroad. I want you to understand that my son did not get, his name was not pulled from a school directory. It was pulled from the Scholastic Books directory. That's an important element as we move forward. Regarding insurance, a lot of these kids are not insured, and it costs $50,000 to $80,000 to repatriate them if they're alive. It can cost $10,000 to $15,000 to repatriate their remains. Often schools leave the parents to their own resources to repatriate their remains. I love you for your idea on insurance. And if we mandate insurance before they play in a sport, there should be insurance carefully applied for when these kids are going abroad. Furthermore, parents must have passports. They have to have a power of attorney, and they need resources to get to their kids if something happens. Regarding education credits, and I want to make sure you're clear on this, my son was promised high school credits to go abroad. and this trip to Japan. Those school credits didn't actually apply to his transcript, but there are school credits for these third-party programs encouraging our kids on these trips. I am a passionate advocate for global exchange programs. I'm proud to say that we've had many. We intend to send our freshmen at the University of Wisconsin to study abroad, but we must do more to ensure their safety, and for that, I am on a mission to save lives and protect our kids abroad, and I thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Ms. Ho. We appreciate very much your powerful testimony today. Thank you for being here. And I'm going to let you go ahead and introduce yourself because I want to make sure we get your name right. Welcome.
Madam Chairman and committee members, my name is Rosario Perez Gutierrez. She's going to make me cry, too. As a child, I always dreamed of traveling the world. Just like the people I saw on TV, I knew my family didn't have a lot of money, and so when I got a letter in the mail saying I was chosen to go on this trip to Japan and represent people-to-people student ambassadors of America, I was excited and at the same time saddened because I knew we couldn't afford it. I had just turned 16 and understood that money was tight. My mom practically raised me on her own. She saw my smile turn into a frown and she asked me if I really wanted to. She was gonna do whatever she had to make it happen because she wanted me to have the experience she never was given. She worked long hours and extra projects at work, and I did what I could at that age. All I could do was babysit. We finally reached our goal. After all that hard work, and we could afford it and fulfill my dream to travel and see the world. But little did I know my trip to Japan was going to change the rest of my life. When we arrived to Japan, the only safety guideline there was, if there was trouble, just call the said number and say, happy birthday. That was really the only instruction given to us. I really feel our leaders didn't care what we did. They didn't even check our rooms at night to make sure we were all there. Little did I know that 911 didn't work in Japan. If we did, would that help? For the program I was in and many others alike, I feel the information on life loss should be known before we work hard to get this money and to try to see if we could be happy and make our goals. Because of this neglection, my group lost a friend, and this world lost a wonderful person. So I ask you guys, please pass the Tyler Sunshine bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gutierrez. You did a great job. We appreciate you being here. Did you have additional testifiers, Representative Seltzer?
No, Madam Chair, I do not.
All right. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. and Mrs. Hill, thank you for being here. Representative Seltzer, for introducing this bill. Thank you for your courage, your strength. We seem to have, unfortunately, several bills this year. Steve's Law, Colton's Law. Your Steve's Law, Colton's Law.
Yes.
Your son, Tyler. But, you know, the work you're doing is not in vain, and thank you for doing that. I've had some experience with this as well, and my wife and I got married very young, and we thought we were adults, but we were children raising children. And I have a now 40-year-old daughter, and when she was 17, and I in my early 30s, she asked if a foreign exchange student could come and stay with us, and successfully we had two or three students that stayed with us. And little did I know or expect that shortly thereafter, she would get an invitation from one of these students to come back to France and visit with them. And my first response was, why in the hell do you think you should be able to go to France when I haven't even been there yet? And so I, like yourself, wanted to make sure that they had an opportunity. This was really before the internet, or before it was readily available about information. But I, in thinking about it and listening to your testimony, realized how naive I was as a parent to send my child all the way overseas as a 17-year-old that really wasn't even on a program but was just going to meet some people on the other side. And I had advised her what I had read about some of the risks, and she called me after landing in Paris and said, Dad, you were right. I was robbed right away the minute I got off the train. So we don't know enough information, and I'm really glad that we're taking this effort to do this. Could you tell me a little bit more about CSIET, what you're involved with in Clear Cause?
Yes, thank you for that. Madam Chairman, Representative, there are a lot of organizations that talk about accreditation. CSIET is an exchange student accreditation program. As Minnesota Statute 5A moved forward because of a poor provider who placed a foreign student at risk in Minnesota, the program was CET USA. In 2010, CET USA had trafficked foreign students in America, labor trafficked at Hershey's and McDonald's. There was some sex trafficking through a program called Pacific Intercultural Exchange. Our co-founder and our board member, Anna Marie Ciernan, testified before the U.S. Department of State for transparency and the right for the U.S. Department of State to sanction programs that would place foreign students at risk on American soil. That has moved forward, and CETUSA and Pacific Intercultural Exchange, along with others, have been sanctioned by the Department of State since then. We are now working with the White House Office of Public Engagement to create similar protections for our students on programs abroad. CSIET still lists CETUSA as an accredited member. So I have serious concerns in a bill that would place faith and trust in an accreditation program that still promotes. None of these accreditation programs, whether it's the Forum on Education Abroad for Higher Ed, or CSIET, or the World Youth Student Travel Confederation, or NAFSA, or Student Youth Travel Association, and to your point, there are thousands of providers, do not have to relinquish any certification to any member, because that's how they get their money and pay the light bill. So I want to just be, we're working on an accreditation program, and our accreditation partners are contract employees in tourism who train Department of State police. We're also working on an online academy to help test the knowledge base of our kids. Some of these kids have never been on a plane, let alone outside of the country. They don't know how to even ask for help in the foreign language or know key phrases. So through the help of one of our advisors, Tom Pescarella, who is retired Department of Justice Drug Enforcement Agency, we are doing student assessment plans for $50 that gives you a little, you know, key phrases, how to get to the closest help place, what you should do in the case of civil unrest. There are a lot of things we could do that we're not doing yet, but we're working on it. So I just want to make sure that this committee understands that just because a program does accreditation does not mean that anybody is authenticating that accreditation.
Thank you, Ms. Hill. Other questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hill, what did the home school district know about your son's opportunity abroad? Did they know who the provider was? I mean, what did you have to do to allow him the release from the district?
You know, and I want to thank you for that question also. And here's an anomaly. The school district was not involved in my son's study abroad program. They received an invitation through the mail from my son sold books for Scholastic Books as a fundraiser. He bought military magazine. He was a history buff. Received a student award for being a history buff. And we received a letter stating that he was named for the honor. He had to go to his school and get some references from some teachers, and then his teacher chaperones were actually from Hopkins. So in our particular situation, the school district had nothing really particularly to do with the study abroad experience. I'm sure that Rosario would agree with that as well. But our kids were promised that they would get high school credits for this experience from a school in Spokane, Washington. Interestingly, those school credits would not have applied to his high school transcript. But there are schools that do have close associations with third-party programs, and I get calls a lot. I want you to know that. Schools call me a lot and say, do you know anything about this program? Do you know anything about this country? How can you help us with this? And I try to guide them. This bill will help your schools. It'll help our schools make informed choices. And here's the other thing. When we can identify what's happening in certain countries, and I know for an example right now, particularly with John Cabot University, it's a higher ed issue in Italy, our kids are getting roofied. They're getting roofied and tossed out of windows and off of bridges. When we know that data, when we mine that data, we can look at it, we can focus in, and we can create quality improvement. What should our programs, what should our faculty, what should those kids know about that situation, and how can we save lives there? Here's another example. One of the leading causes of death is drowning. Our kids in Minnesota do not understand what a flag on a beach means. They don't understand that it could mean dangerous critter, dangerous riptides, rip currents, or dangerous bacteria. So we're on a mission to make sure they go in heads up, fully informed, with the ability to identify and mitigate risks and contact their families. We created an app that is a global award winner on the smallest available bandwidth to help them notify their families. It's free. So I hope that answers your question. And thank you.
Other questions? Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Seltzer, just as I was reading through the statute and looking at this, and I don't think you put on, but you mentioned the Minnesota Department of Education. Would you also put this information on the Secretary of State website?
Representative Seltzer.
You know, Representative Crescia, as I was reading through our final language, I noticed that was an omission because I want to make it clear, first of all, that our Secretary of State is not like the U.S. Secretary of State, as we all know, but still that's where people think of going. So I've spoken with the Secretary of State office, and I don't know if Julie's still here. Yeah, you want to come on? Is it all right if Julie comes up here? Julie Strother. Oh, I guess it is in there. Yeah.
Welcome. If you would just please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Julie Strother with the Office of the Minnesota Secretary of State. And as I believe Representative Seltzer was saying, that there is a provision under 3.24 to 3.26 that does have our office publishing the information that's given to the Department of Education on our site. And I think the intent was that the Department of Education would get the information first, would aggregate it, and then we would essentially mirror the publication on our site with the idea that if there is any concern about private data and they work with the schools all the time, that they would be the primary point of contact with the schools. But we would mirror what they publish on our site.
Representative Crescia.
And thank you. And I'm sorry, your name again?
Julie Strother.
Last name again?
Strother.
Strother. And just for consideration, I would actually reverse that process, only because as the business entity and then have it go to the you might want to just consider that. I think you guys have the stronger position. But nonetheless, very good bill, and thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the Secretary of State's office, is there any reason why before this even could possibly get implemented, you could not post an advisory or a warning to all of our residents and participants in programs to make information available that there are certain considerations you need to think about and maybe even advising of efforts, not necessarily pending law, but efforts that are underway to provide more information?
Ms. Strother.
Madam Chair, Representative, because this is something that our office hasn't been involved in the past, we had a very limited role in registering those organizations that place high school students in Minnesota. We haven't had something like that on our site, and now that our office is both with the post-secondary bill that was passed into law last year and is going into sort of full effect this fall, now that we're getting more involved, that's something we could look at. It just hadn't been an area that we operated it in until recently.
Just a voluntary advisory.
Thank you. Representative Mark Martin.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick point. I know the Attorney General's office has all sorts of kind of consumer alerts, like for college students vacationing or on spring break or doing with rental. You can go on there, and there's all sorts of kind of informational things that would cover that, but I don't know if a lot of people realize that's out there, for example, but it's a real good resource for that type of thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hi. Seltzer, just a quick question, and I applaud your efforts. I think this is very important. Now, my children have not done travel abroad as high school students, but my college daughter did, and I'm just wondered if you looked into, because I think it's very common for college students to go, and you know, I completely embarrassed my daughter by being the only parent that emailed the professor with a very detailed list of questions. You know, they're kind of used to it now, but anyway, so embarrassing. Did you consider expanding your bill to covering those types of travel abroad experiences as well?
Thank you, Representative Loon, and that bill was passed last session. Okay. And the first, in November 1st of this coming, in this fall, the first report will be out on that. And it will be posted on both the Office of Higher Education's website and the Secretary of State's website.
Thank you. Yeah, Ms. Hill.
And that bill was in honor of Thomas Plotkin from Hopkins, whose life fell away in India. His body was not recovered on a National Outdoor Leadership School. I want to thank Senator Bonhoff and Representative Seltzer for leading our country.
Thank you. I felt it was important that we draw attention to that, because I think, again, many parents are faced with those decisions when you're now adult, but still your child student approaches you with those experiences. So, Representative Seltzer.
And thank you, Representative Loon. And I just want to point out that when Cheryl and the rest of the folks and Elizabeth Brenner, Tommy Poppin's mom, who is my constituent, came to me, they pointed out also that even on the post-secondary level, where these experiences are even more common, that there are that we have lots of laws, which we should, you know, that protect students that come here, but we have no laws, in the United States, until the one Minnesota passed last year, that even shines a light on the safety records of the programs. Then this is a multi-billion dollar industry.
Ms. Hill.
Madam Chairman, Representatives, I do want to share as an example, because of the work of Senator Bonhoff and Representative Seltzer, we do have a federal bill introduced, the Ravi Thakurdin Sunshine Law, which is 1541.
Thank you. Additional questions? All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this legislation? All right, seeing none, Representative Seltzer, closing comments?
And I just want to thank you, Representative Loon, for hearing this bill, and committee members for all of your thoughtful questions. And I think, Chair Loon, that everything that should be said has been said.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Seltzer. And I want to thank you, Ms. Hill and Ms. Gutierrez, for your testimony. Thank you very much. I know it was difficult, but we appreciate you telling your stories to us today. And with that, Representative Seltzer renews her motion that House File 1542, as amended, be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. And with that, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, your bill is on its way to State Government Finance.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Representative Quam. All right, Representative Quam, you want to go ahead and move House File 648? I believe your motion is to re-refer to Tax Committee, but with the Chair's intention of laying it over today.
That's the correct one. I'm going to confirm, because I wanted to make sure that we refer it to the... Madam Chair, I was under the impression that this would be held over for possible inclusion.
It will be, Representative. It's just that the bill will eventually have to be heard in taxes, and the Education Finance Omnibus Bill will have to go through Tax Committee. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to confirm, because I had anticipated a motion that was to be for possible inclusion. So if the staff could, the appropriate verbiage, so I do it correctly then?
Your motion would be that House File 648 be re-referred to Tax Committee, but with the intention of the chair to lay it over today for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And because this was recalled and re-referred, there was an amendment that was generated and sent out over a week ago, but it did not move with the bill in re-referring. And I believe there's there are copies available for the A15-0046 amendment.
All right. Yeah, so thank you, Representative Quam. Members, you should be in your packets. Oh, I'm sorry. It's being distributed right now. So I think what we'll do, Representative Quam, is just have you discuss the amendment, because we didn't have it within the 24 hours. We'll come back and address it when we start marking up the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in the sake of time, I thought I might have the testifier speak, then have questions on the bill as it stands, and then we could have a informational discussion on the amendment.
That sounds just fine. Thank you, Representative Quam. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Loon, members of the Education Finance Committee. My name is Brenda Lewis. I'm the Assistant Superintendent with Rochester Public Schools. Thanks so much for taking the time to listen to what I have to say today. At Rochester Public Schools, we strive always to hire certified teachers. Unfortunately, sometimes we are in situations where we are unable to find a highly qualified certified teacher. This is specifically difficult when it comes to CTE certifications. Unfortunately, there are a limited number of post-secondary institutions that offer that CTE certification. There's a looming shortage of skilled workers that's top of the minds for business leaders in Rochester, as well as across our state. This is a real and serious issue that has the potential to undermine the strength of individual businesses and the broader prosperity of our state. Businesses need to collaborate with educational institutions to build a pool of skilled workers. I would like to share with you a collaboration that is going on in Rochester. Due to the City of Rochester renewing a local half-cent sales tax, we will be opening a new Career and Tech Ed Center in the fall of 2016. This is a partnership with Rochester Public Schools, Rochester Community and Tech College, as well as Winona State. We worked with the Rochester Area Chamber of Commerce and 35 business leaders to determine the career pathways for a new center that would address the skills needed for the many jobs that are available in our Rochester area. Working with our business leaders for several months, we landed on the following career pathways: ag, engineering, health science, hospitality, information systems, manufacturing, and construction. This has been a coordinated effort between secondary and post-secondary educators and community partners, providing the pathways to our in-demand careers. We are excited about the opportunities that we will be able to provide for our students while ensuring a skilled workforce for the Rochester area. Increasing the number of Minnesotans with the education, skills, and training needed for the economy is a multi-layered strategy. Some of the steps to achieve this goal include making teaching and learning in secondary schools more rigorous, engaging, and relevant, ensuring that more students are college and career ready, increasing high school graduation rates, especially for our lower performing students. While addressing these issues will require significant change across the entire education system, increasing opportunities for students to participate in high quality career and tech ed is a comprehensive strategy that impacts all of them. Career and technical education is an educational strategy for providing young people with the academic, technical, and employability skills and knowledge to pursue post-secondary training or higher ed and enter a career field, preparing them for ongoing learning. Well-qualified educators are essential to providing that high-quality and effective CTE programming. However, there are several barriers to ensuring these well-qualified teachers are in the classroom. First, CTE teachers must meet more stringent certification requirements than core academic teachers. In Minnesota, CTE teachers must have a CTE credential. Colleges of education rarely have a CTE training track, which results in a shortage of teacher candidates who have received training and the skills needed to teach CTE courses. Fortunately, local employers can be leveraged to help strengthen teacher instruction and provide an invaluable link to industry practitioners. In an economy that requires well-trained and highly skilled professionals, Career and Tech Ed is a proven method for rewarding young people with the knowledge and skills necessary to be successful members of our workforce. If we are to make good on our commitment to graduate more students from high school prepared to face post-secondary challenges, schools must continue to improve CTE, ensuring that students have access to high-quality pathways to success. Using career and tech revenue for salaries paid to non-licensed community experts allows us to offer comprehensive career and technical programs and not force us to eliminate a career pathway due to our inability to find a licensed teacher with CTE certification. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Do you have any other testifiers today, Representative Guam? All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 648? All right. Questions from members? Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as I understand it, in Rochester, there is a demand for workers with the skills necessary to take jobs in the community that are career and technical related. So to fill that need for employers in Rochester, public dollars are suggested here as the source of instructional costs for business leaders, technical leaders in the Rochester greater community to be able to come into the Rochester public schools and assist in the education of young people to provide labor to meet the unmet need for the community in Rochester. Tell me why. First of all, tell me if I'm incorrect, and if I am even partially correct, tell me how that can be in the public's interest.
Ms. Lewis.
Okay, Madam Chair and Representative, what we are actually asking for is that if we are unable to find a highly qualified certified teacher in that area after first looking, recruiting, etc., then we are asking for community expert.
Representative Kwam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is an effort to provide the world's best workforce and to provide options to the students in the area for positions that maybe are a little bit more diverse than the normal PSEO and college route, and therefore is, you know, it's to design something for the students for their career that they wish to go into, because frankly not each student fits into the present format, and because of Rochester being regional and a very growing area with innovation, the school district is used to partnering with the community college, the VOTEC. That's what we called them in the day. They're probably different names now. But to provide those career options and paths so that the students can have a career that they enjoy, and it also provides the labor force, the world's best labor force, hopefully, for the region and the state.
Representative Anzels.
I have trouble with the concept here, but that's probably just some bias that I have somewhere. I'll let any further questions go.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, along those lines, Representative Anzels, so we heard a bill earlier, I think it was the omnibus policy bill, where there will be a permanent change, it seems to me, regarding these instructors, so that they won't need to be licensed any further. And it seems to me then that if we do that, then I suppose this bill is necessary in order for us to pay them with this revenue source. And so the effort under that scenario will be that there will be no search for licensed individuals, because the law says you won't need a licensed individual to provide these career and tech courses. So it'll be interesting to see as we move the these bills forward, what the interplay is going to be between these two, if we move them, if we move both of them, or if we move one as opposed to the other. But I do think that core to this, it's objectively fair for us to consistently ask the question about quality, and the ability for students to be able to access quality, and how do we assure that quality instruction is going to be delivered if we're going to be adopting a new major way to deliver instruction using non-licensed career tech instructors.
Representative Murphy.
Ms. Lewis, do you anticipate that if this passes, that the community expert will be paid on the remuneration on the teachers, commensurate with what the teacher would get, or what their career expertise would demand?
Ms. Lewis.
Madam Chair, Representative, they would be paid on our per our teacher contract.
Follow-up, Representative Murphy. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the superintendent again, I want to get your last name right again. How do you pronounce it?
Lewis.
Lewis. I'm sorry. I'm getting old.
Very difficult.
So the question I have, and I want to go back to my teaching experience as well. I think we keep separating out this community expert and bringing them in, but in your school district, have you created any classes like digital media or other ones for student need that nobody had experience teaching those classes? And who taught those?
Ms. Lewis.
Hey, Madam Chair, Representative, we actually currently offer American Sign Language, and there is no licensure that actually exists for that program, so we actually have to do the community expert as one example.
And thank you, Ms. Lewis.
And
the reason I bring this up, for schools are trying to be nimble all the time. When I first started out as a language arts teacher, we expanded out into digital media, Cisco Network, and all these, when no licensure existed. And the question was, did we give the students an opportunity and try to put in somebody who could learn it? So here's my real question, I guess. Let me ask this. What makes a good teacher, in your opinion? Someone who can classroom manage and write curriculum, or a subject matter expert?
Ms. Lewis.
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative, I would say it's both an individual that has the science of teaching and the art of teaching that can connect with our students to make sure that they are learning the content area in a way that's motivating and stimulating for them, and someone that's able to reteach that concept and do whatever it takes to ensure that they understand it.
Representative Crescia.
And thank you, Ms. Lewis, and I'm so glad that's on tape. And my next question is, does a degree ensure that does licensure ensure that you're going to have those qualities? And you don't have to answer the question.
I'll pass on that. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, just a comment, you know, in one of my high schools that I represent, we had a real hard problem finding an auto tech. We have a great a program in our school, and eventually they, you know, they found somebody in the industry that came in and taught the courses in auto tech, you know, the auto mechanics and the whole works. They have they have auto lifts, and they do an excellent job, and actually teachers do take their vehicles in there to have them worked on. But it was a hard finding somebody with a degree, so they had to go to industry. So.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know this is a finance issue, but you know, we've had community experts in our schools since 1985, and so I wanted to ask Superintendent Lewis, to what extent do you scrutinize those who come to you who perhaps would become your community experts, and who sits down and reviews their credentials before you submit that to the Board of Teaching?
Ms. Lewis.
Hey, Madam Chair, Representative, I just want to first clarify that I'm actually the assistant superintendent, so multiple of you have given me a promotion.
Thank you.
Anyway, so our process is one where first it starts with the application process, so individuals that are interested complete the application. We vet, as I think I said earlier, all of the candidates, if we have any, that are licensed. Then if we do not have any licensed candidates, then we move to our folks that are unlicensed. We have an interview for them with them. We do reference checks, and then our executive director of human resources, myself, and the superintendent review the credentials that we have, and then we bring forward the application to the Minnesota Department of Education on that individual.
Thank you. Other questions? All right. Seeing none, Representative Quam, any final words?
Yes, Madam Chair. One that, you know, members, this is just one of many where we're trying to take care of some issues. And I am very open. I tried to connect with the trades with the possibility of seeing if they could help cooperate with some community experts to bring back some of the when I was a kid, we had woodworking and metals and some other things that were optional that many schools don't have. So, you know, this is sort of an area that I think is getting a lot of different attention for this, ag, and et cetera. And thank you for hearing. Is this the appropriate time for me to mention or refer to what's in the amendment that we will not be addressing today?
If you want to briefly discuss that, sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The amendment is basically to give the appropriate verbiage so that you can actually utilize the funds. And so the main part of it, besides putting in some and qualifying and referring to the paragraph E, is the paragraph E, 1.5 through 1.7 on the amendment. Salaries for unlicensed community experts qualify under paragraph A, clauses 1 and 2, if the district first made efforts to obtain acceptable licensed teachers for the particular course or subject area. And that's what we're looking at for completeness.
Thank you, Representative Brown. And Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Quam, that begs the question, without the amendment, are community experts in the Rochester School District paid according to the collective bargaining agreement that exists in the district between the district and licensed staff?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Anzels. I believe that was touched upon on an earlier question. My understanding is the amendment would clarify some ambiguity and make it more clear, but it's also something that could be appropriately addressed in the Tax Committee, where apparently this would end up going, if possibly included.
Representative Anzels.
I mean, I'm trying to find a reason to support this. So is the answer yes, they are paid according to the salary schedule, or no, they're not?
Representative Quam.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Representative, I believe the question I heard from Assistant Superintendent Lewis was they are paid according to the scale, not according to what their outside experience rate would be.
Good.
All right. Any additional questions? I see our next committee is moving in, so we probably better vacate. So with that, Representative Quam renews his motion that House Bill 648 be re-referred to Tax Committee, but it's the intention of the chair to lay it over today. And with that, we are done with the business today. The committee is adjourned.